Hi everyone, and thank you very much for joining us on another episode of Lid Publishing's podcast, Lid Radio. My name is Miro, and as always, I will be your host for today's show. With me today is a very special guest. It is Brendan Hall. How are you today, Brendan?
Great. Thanks very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
It's the pleasure is all mine. And of course, for our listeners, Brendan is a professional yacht racing skipper, author, and leadership expert. He is also an entrepreneur, and he has come today to talk about his book and a lot of the themes and ideas behind leadership, management, and his philosophy. Now, the first question I ask everyone on the podcast, Brendan, is what actually inspired you to become an author, and what was the story behind the book?
So what inspired me to become an author is I did this yacht race, and then about 10 months after the race, I was speaking to one of my crew on the phone, and he told me a story about something that happened on the race, and I said, you know what, I'd completely forgotten that that happened. And you only just reminded me of it now. And I thought, and he said to me, yeah, actually, in 10 years' time, that's probably what most of it's going to feel like. It'll all just blur together. So I thought, crikey, I've got to capture this somehow now whilst it's still fresh in my mind. So I wrote as a memoir. I think it's just an interesting world that we occupy, 20 people crammed together on this yacht. The tensions and the conflicts that arose in that environment. I wanted to give the reader an insight into the hostile world that we lived in, what the 27 vertical meter waves of the North Pacific looked like, but also to give an insight into the internal landscape of what it's like being a leader in those kind of conditions. And the book's quite raw, it's quite honest. You know, I speak quite openly about my feelings and my faults and failings. I'm not always the hero of the story, and what I went through leading a team of amateur sailors in that really difficult environment. And the second reason for writing the book was because of the leadership lessons that I learned. You know, it's such a unique world, the Clipper Race. You've got these 10 yachts with these 10 identical crews. They've all got the same starting resources. They're broadly following the same strategy. And then at the end of the race, after this 10-month epic adventure, they're ranked first to 10th in the race. And, you know, I was always curious as to what made the difference between the boats that came first and the boats that came 10th. And seeing as when I did my race, my boat was the one that came out ranked first, we won the race by a considerable margin, I wanted to capture that stuff, that real gold and those gems that led to our eventual victory, and sort of put that down in words for other people to benefit from.
Yeah, and what a fascinating experience that is. And focusing a bit on the sort of leadership and management aspect of the whole thing, what really sticks out for me is that a yacht race like this is described as the ultimate long distance challenge. Now, can you perhaps tell us what was going through your mind as you were going to start something like this?
Well, the days just before the race began were just some of the most tense in my entire life. I mean, it was so full on. We were just so busy with a jobs list that was never ending. And what really strikes out for me at that point was just how big of a leap into uncertainty we were taking. I mean, for me, our first race was going to be from Hull, where the race began, down to La Rochelle in France, so about 500 miles, which, you know, was not an enormous journey for me, being an ocean racing sailor anyway, but for the crew, 40% of whom have never stepped on a boat before they sign up to do this race. For them, this is this enormous journey into uncertainty. So that was the feeling I got, and all the attendant feelings, the excitement, the anticipation. And on the day of the race start, I remember this like it was yesterday. We'd just been up on the big stage, all the 10 teams being introduced to the crowd. And, you know, it was a fantastic moment, really sort of ego boosting. And it was fantastic. 10,000 people there in front of us. And we were walking from the stage down off the side to where our yachts were parked. And this face jumped out of the side of the crowd as we were walking down this narrow alleyway with everyone cheering and clapping. And it was one of the crew from a previous edition of the race. And he was someone that on his race had been washed overboard the Southern Ocean, thought he was going to die. The boat was doing a very emergency search and rescue to try and find him. And just in the nick of time, they found him and got him back on board. But this guy was as close to death, really, as you can be. And he grabbed me and he said in that moment, Brendan, keep them safe. Promise me you'll keep them safe. My 20 crew, he meant. And I mean, it just brought me back to earth with a bang. The enormous responsibility that I had taken on and signed up for and really knew about, of course, but maybe in a more abstract way. But just hearing him say that really brought home to me my primary goal was to look after this team of people in my care and keep them safe so they could come back and see their loved ones 10 months later.
Right, absolutely. And that is quite a challenge, I think, for any one individual to undertake. And of course, it feeds into the idea of leadership and management. And can you perhaps tell us the kind of preparation that you had to do, not only physically, but as well mentally, before you started? And then how did that preparation eventually help you when you transitioned into the leadership and management area?
Sure. Well, I mean, in preparation for the race, physically, I'd just been sailing yachts sort of forever. And so you kind of get boat fit. I wasn't smashing out reps in the gym really to prepare. So sailors tend to have a particular shape because you can't really walk that far. You have scrawny little legs, but because you're winching and using your upper body to pull on all the ropes, you tend to have this sort of triangular shape. So that was kind of me before the start of the race. But mentally was where all my preparation happened. And, you know, my research to do this race and be a skipper on it began 2 years before I was even eligible to put my name down to sign up for the job. And my first step was to go and interview as many previous race skippers as I could. And I remember meeting the previous edition's winning skipper, this dodgy bar in Portsmouth. And I went in and what I wanted from him was all these technical details. I wanted to know his polar figures, his VMG diagrams, his weather information, all this technical stuff. And I remember he pulled me up short and said, "Brendan, you're barking up the wrong tree here." He said, "The best sailor isn't going to win this race. It's the best leader." And in fact, the only number he gave me all night was when he said, "This race is going to come down to 80% people skills, 20% sailing skills." And I remember at the time kind of having to stifle this impulse to roll my eyes because that just didn't seem right to me. You know, yacht racing is a technical sport. It's one of the most technical sports. And I was convinced that the winning or losing was going to come down to, you know, technical ability.
Skill, yeah.
Technical skills, yeah, exactly. But, you know, I didn't discount what he had to say out of hand. So in my further research, I came to see the wisdom in what he was saying. And by the time we were at that start point, that day we left Hull, I was very much come around to his way of thinking. And I knew that for us to be successful and for my preparations to have been worthwhile, I would need to be focused in that place. 80% people skills, 20% sailing skills, because this was a race of 10 teams, not a race of 10 yachts.
Right. And going on for that, it seems that leadership plays a very important part in a situation like this. But translating it into a business environment, would you say that the same sort of 80% to 20% applies in that area, or would you perhaps say it might be slightly different?
No, I think it applies universally. I mean, the second part of my preparation was, you know, when this skipper had convinced me that that's where I needed to be focusing my energy and my attention, I the question changed from how do I become this great yacht racer to sort of how do I become this great leader of people. So I went online, I went onto Amazon as we do nowadays, and I bought probably the 50 bestseller leadership books out there. I spent the midnight oil just reading them all, you know, politics, sport, military, everything I could find, and digesting it and picking out the bits that I liked and excluding the rest. And so actually from most of the great leadership ideas that I took on board with me did come from the business world. And I think that real great leadership looks the same no matter where it's practiced, whatever context it's in. And through every great organizational culture, there are these threads and these themes that seem very, very consistent. So yeah, I think one and the same. They look the same wherever they're practiced. And certainly that 80%, 20%, when someone steps up into their first leadership role, that's the ideal they should be heading towards. They might not be there at the start, but the further they go up the ladder, that's the place they need to be aiming for.
And as I was listening here to you, I think there's one question that really sticked out in my mind, and that was actually, what was the biggest challenge during the event? You know, was there any one aspect that really stuck out?
The biggest challenge during the event was probably dealing with my own emotional intelligence, or gaining emotional intelligence, I should say. And I was 26 when I started the race, so I was the youngest of all the 10 skippers competing. So I hadn't really thought much about emotional intelligence, but on the race I learned the profound value of it. And I would say when I first started the race, I was not an emotionally intelligent leader. And I'd be quite open about that. In fact, I could probably be quite emotionally volatile. You know, the race was this massive world of uncertainty, and it was throwing change at us every single day. And I was there. I mean, I think of it like I was this sort of can of Coke, just being shaken every single day, until eventually the pressure builds up, you open it, and it explodes and goes everywhere. And that's not what the team needed. We would get our position report every 6 hours on the race, and whether we had a good one and we'd made miles on the rest of the fleet, or we'd had a bad one and it meant we'd lost miles, the other boats had sort of overtaken us, gone past us, you know, my mood would fluctuate massively. And I had to learn to control that. And the crew gave me some feedback on this, that it was not behavior they needed in a leader, not what they wanted, it wasn't sustainable. So I had to really learn some emotional intelligence and understand that my mood becomes the mood of the crew. Right. And I would say on any given day, my mood counted for at least 50% of the mood of the crew, which was massive and far greater proportion than I would have expected.
And truly, when it comes to having results, that would have an absolute ginormous impact. I mean, if it would affect someone's morale half the time, that can have huge implications.
Absolutely. And it was also, I realized pretty early on the first leg of the race, sailing down the Atlantic, that how we dealt collectively with our emotions was going to have a huge bearing on whether our campaign was a success or a failure, particularly our negative emotions, how we bounce back from setbacks. And so if I wanted the crew to, you know, be resilient and be able to overcome those setbacks, then I would need to be that role model, that example of how to deal with those negative emotions really well. And for me to behave in the way I was, that really emotionally volatile leader, was to give them tacit permission to give voice to their own emotional excesses. And on a small yacht with 20 people in that cramped, highly pressurized environment, it would just be a disaster. So I needed to be that living, breathing, walking example of how to be that calm person. The bottle of water that you can shake no matter how much, and it's always the same, you know, it doesn't fizz over and explode.
Absolutely. Now, can you perhaps give our listeners three tips on how they can deal with being thrown in the deep end of a management or leadership situation? What can they do to take control?
Well, I'm going to challenge you there, because I would say that one of the most important lessons is not to take control, but to give control. So one of the cornerstones of our success on the race was me using some very deliberate strategies around empowerment and autonomizing the crew, giving control to other people, not keeping it all to myself. And I knew that that would be hugely motivational for the crew. All the frameworks that I'd read in my research before the race pointed to the fact that acting with control and volition and choice and autonomy is hugely motivating. And I read this study that really floored me from Cornell University in the States, where they followed 420 small businesses, half of whom had a very autonomous approach where the workers were given a large amount of control over what they did and how they did it, and the others were a much more top-down, I tell you what to do, you do what I say type structure. And the group that had the highly autonomous approach grew at four times the speed of the other group and had one-third the turnover, the people turnover, I mean.
Right.
And that just floored me, and that's exactly what I wanted in my team. So I very actively gave responsibility and fostered that autonomy and shared that power with my crew as the race went on, to the point where I made myself redundant on deck from a day-to-day point of view. So, you know, and that had huge main benefits. The first was it was really motivating. The second was that it allowed me time to focus on strategy, to pull back from sort of working in the business to on the business. That's where I could add the most value, was in the tactical weather routing, the strategy, and just being a good leader as well, getting adequate rest to be able to do that. And the third reason for that approach was, to be honest with you, it was death.
Right.
I had to be sure that at a minimum, my crew could sail the boat to a safe port of call from anywhere in the world in the event that I was killed, incapacitated, or washed over the side. So to any of your listeners that are leaders themselves, I would say run a little thought experiment for me now. You know, what happens when you don't turn up to work next Monday morning? You're not dead, but you're certainly not there. What happens? What decisions are being made and what decisions aren't being made? Is your tight control of that leadership, because you think that's your responsibility and that's your job description, is that actually creating a bottleneck? What happens if you're not there?
And actually, as you say that, do you perhaps think that leaders can try and give too much value to their teams and in companies, which can end up being a negative thing in the long run?
Yeah, absolutely. They can. They certainly can. And, you know, it's like the chairman of GE, Jack Welch, said, you know, when you become you get your first leadership role, it's no longer about you. You know, it's no longer about your performance. You're not the hero. You're not being judged. It's all about your team now. And that's where that's how your results will be judged. So I think a lot of leaders struggle with putting down that heroic leader mantle and embracing what is a more mature leadership style, that style of servant leadership, which may be less, shall we say, ego gratifying, but actually leads to a far deeper and more meaningful relationship with their team, and the results that will go along with that will be far greater.
Feedback seems to be a very important part of giving people the autonomy and the authority that they need to deal with their everyday life. How can we handle something as delicate as feedback without damaging someone's ego or perhaps their sense of self-worth?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, we all do have an ego, we all do have a sense of self-worth. And actually, one of my crew said something interesting to me in one of our coaching sessions, which I did with every single crew member in every single stopover of the race. It was a culture of coaching that we had. And she said to me, "Brendan, you probably don't realize it, but you're holding the remote control for my confidence." And, you know, with a positive, affirming gesture or some kind words, you can really build me up. But equally, you know, with maybe a sarcastic look or an offhand comment, you can really bring me down. And, you know, I didn't really know what to say to that. And the more I reflected on it, the more I thought that, you know, I'm holding this remote control. Whether I feel I am, it doesn't matter. It matters if that's what she thinks. And it, you know, I kind of pushed back against it. And, well, I didn't sign up to hold this damn remote control. I'm here to sail around the world. And right. My job as a skipper, I don't want your remote control. But actually, I had to grow up and realize that as a leader, I was holding it, you know, whether I wanted to or not. And I had to use it very wisely and very judiciously and understand that shadow that I cast over the team and be very mindful of that. So getting back to your point on feedback, I think that giving that feedback done in a sensitive, affirming way, but also in a very direct and honest way is really, really important. So it's finding that balance at all times. And I tell you what, if you can give 4 bits of good feedback to every bit of negative developmental feedback, then that's a really golden number, 4-1, I would say.
4-1, great, that's a great piece of advice. And the last question I ask anyone that comes on a podcast actually is, what are you currently reading?
So I'm reading a great book at the moment called Everything That Remains by these two young guys, call themselves the Minimalists. And it's a great book all about minimalism and what it stands for. And it really struck a chord with me because some of the happiest times of my life were when I was at sea, when I was on the Clipper race. I mean, we had a personal limit of 20 kilograms for every single person. So I had on this boat my entire life's possessions, and it weighed no more than 20 kilograms stuffed into these little lockers. But it was the most purposeful and most motivated and most driven part of my life. And I'm particularly reflective upon this at this time of year. You know, it's coming up to Christmas, and with the present buying and the sort of consumption that happens around that. So something that really struck me when I was on the yacht was just what it feels like to have finite resources. You know, you have this finite amount of food, of fuel, of water, and you have to make it last and you have to make it work. And contrast to that, you know, I'm now back living ashore, working in the leadership and management space, but just being dragged back into, you know, what I might call the treadmill of consumption, of accumulation and status, and feeling the pull of those things on my life. And this book's really great because it's helping me get back to see what is really meaningful and, you know, just try and put some of that stuff to one side.
Great, perfect. And of course, for those listening, if that does sound interesting to you, we'll put a link in the description below. You can go, you can find out more about that book itself. But with that, I would like to thank you very much, Brendan, for joining us today on the podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And of course, for our listeners, if you enjoyed what we talked about today, in the description below, you can find links to not only Team Spirit, but also to what Brendan is up to and what is he doing. And of course, If you were very much into what we talked about, you can find out more at the World Class Leadership Conference 2018, Navigating Uncharted Territory, where you will be able to find Brendan there, and he will be talking in much more detail about the wonderful topics we discussed today. Of course, as always, we would like to thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast, and you can find us on our social media platforms, at Lid Radio, and once again, we look very much forward to seeing you next week.